It feels as if the greats are leaving us. Every generation probably feels that way. But when golf legend Arnold Palmer died yesterday at 87, he was called the king, the guy who made your father feel he could be one too, even if he played a public course. Florida Marlins pitcher Jose Fernandez died on Sunday as well in a boating accident. He could have been king. We'll never know. But he was a crown prince, just 24, National League Rookie of the Year in 2013, twice an All-Star. Then there was Edward Albee. He died last week at 88, a voice stilled, a fist no longer shaking at the heavens. He won 3 Tonys, including one for Lifetime Achievement, 3 Pulitzers, best known for his 1962 play Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which was later made into a film starring Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor as the sparring couple George and Martha.
You make me puke.
It wasn't a very nice thing to say, Martha.
That wasn't what?
A very nice thing to say.
Oh, I like your anger. I think that's what I like about you most, your anger.
We've spoken to Albee a couple of times. In April of 2007, when he came to our studios, he'd just been part of a forum asking if American theater had a future. So we asked him, does it?
Oh, it depends on so many things. It depends upon whether we ever start educating people in the arts again in our school system. Mm-hmm. Unless we can have a society that cares something about the arts and is informed about the arts, you can't possibly have people going to see serious theater or dance or anything.
You know, I forgot about that. You know, we were forced to put on some of the dramas in middle school and high school, and now look on back on that with joy.
Yeah, but the kids just aren't educated anymore. But the reason there's always going to be theater is the thing that distinguishes live theater from television and film is that live theater is happening to you, a real experience as opposed to a synthetic experience.
And a passive one.
Yes. You always know that film and television aren't true. In theater, there's that wonderful phrase, suspension of disbelief. Mm. You never suspend your disbelief on television or film. Mm. But if something is really working on stage and it's a live performance and you're there, you lose contact with the fact that these are a bunch of actors pretending to be people, and it's a fake set and everything, and all of a sudden you're in a real situation. Mm. And you don't get much reality in society anymore. You certainly don't get much reality in the arts.
What are some of the practical problems confronting theaters? I've heard, read you speak of cost.
The costs of everything have gone up terribly. That's because, I don't even want to talk about why, but...
What are some of the reasons why? I'll quote you. You say that when Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was first staged, I think I have this right, it was $45,000. Now
on Broadway, yes.
Yeah, sure there was inflation, but now...
And the inflation has not kept up with the rise of theater costs. The last production we did on Broadway cost $1.5 million. Mm. Everybody's salaries have gone up, of course, but the cost of renting theaters have gone up. The cost of advertising has gone up so much more than anything else. One-third of a budget for a play now is advertising.
Really? One-third.
You know, even off-Broadway, where I started and where I started seeing theater long before I wrote plays, was $2 and $3 to get into a performance. Now it's $75, $80, even off-Broadway. And kids can't get there.
I've shared with you that I had a short theater experience in a play here in Boston, and I was astonished at the actors who... the commitments they made for the little money that they made mm-hmm. in return.
Sure.
And it's true, of course, of playwrights as well. You spoke to a master class for high school students at the Museum of Modern Art. What are some of the things they have to do?
They have to be willing to stay with theater in spite of the blandishments of television and film, where they can, at least in theory, make a great deal more money, even though they'll lose their souls doing it.
I was going to say, do you think you can do both, or does it corrupt your playwright?
You can't do both, basically, because you have absolutely no control over your own work when you write for television and film. There are other people that are constantly changing your work without your permission. The great thing about being a playwright is nobody can change a word of what you've written without your permission.
Mm. Although you've said, they will try to make you take a play that's perfectly happy at 3.5 hours and make it 2 hours.
They will, but that's commercial. That's commerce. Unless you give in to the blandishments of commerce and hold the fact that this is a serious play and it's a certain length and it's about certain things, and I'm not going to make it simpler to reach the simple-minded. I've written this play for people of a certain intelligence and who wish to participate in something that's not going to make them giddy necessarily, except giddy with self-awareness maybe, that's which is great. And they have to do it on my terms. Hmm. That's the nice thing about theater. You don't have to sell out.
If you're just joining us, we're revisiting part of our 2007 conversation with the late Tony and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Edward Albee. More of his advice for young playwrights included a list of pointers, beginning with, don't write too soon. Get to know your characters.
Yeah, so many people start off and they think they've got a wonderful idea. And so they'll start writing and page 42, they stop. They don't really know what they're doing. They haven't let it gestate. It hasn't thought through yet.
Well, you gave us an extreme example of that when we spoke a couple of years ago when you were on the program. The example involves your play, The Zoo Story, with two men meeting around a park bench.
One of whom ends up dead by the end of the play.
Yes, there's that. And there was a sequel of sorts, second act, if you will, called Home Life.
Well, actually, the Home Life is the first act of the two-act play, The Zoo Story being the second act.
But you wrote Home Life second.
I wrote Home Life 42 years after I wrote The Zoo Story because I realized I had two characters on stage in The Zoo Story, one of whom is called Jerry, who talks all the time, and we know everything about him. We don't learn very much about Peter, the publisher, who was sitting in the park. And I wanted to know more about him. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting? Also, whenever The Zoo Story is done, I have to approve of whatever play is being done with it. And I get so tired of having to approve of plays. I said, gee, if I write a play, which is the first act, I don't have to approve anything anymore because I got to do the two together. And so I hadn't thought about the character Peter ever since I wrote The Zoo Story 40-some years ago. But I started writing this play about Peter at home with his wife, Anne, whom I'd never met.
In your head.
But I had her there.
Did you? That's what I mean.
I had her there because even when I wrote The Zoo Story, Peter had a wife. And obviously I knew who she was, but with going back to revisiting Peter, it was so simple to do. I knew who he was. I knew who his wife Anne was. I knew everything about where they lived, their environment. Right. I'd kept it in my head all those years, which is interesting.
So there's number one on the list, get to know your characters.
You really have to know them.
Perhaps not keep them in your head for 47 years.
Well, but you don't have to keep them talking to you all the time, but as long as you have them there and you can bring them back. That's fine.
Here's some other things that Edward Albee said. You said to these students, write absolutely real people in real situations.
Well, unless you're going to write a real three-dimensional character, you're writing an essay. And unless you can write dialogue that is true to a real situation, you're faking it. You're writing ideas rather than people.
Let's see. Never lecture. Don't be obscure. Never become someone's opinion of you.
No, never do that. No, never allow yourself. I tell my students, every time you write a play, whether it's your second play or your 30th play, it's the first play you've ever written. You've got to begin all over again each time. So you're not influenced by what you've done. And you don't imitate yourself consciously or unconsciously.
So you cannot be, when you sit down and write, you cannot think of yourself as Edward Albee, one of America's greatest playwrights, master of the acerbic dialogue as illustrated in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
No, of course not. Yeah. No, I'm writing my first play. I'd be burdened by comparisons, and I don't want to do that myself.
Just finishing out the list, you tell these young writers, every line has two purposes. One to delineate character, the other to advance the plot. Everything else is waste.
Yeah. You can't just go around wasting time. Plays exist in present time. And if you're vamping or wasting time, people become aware of it and they turn off and don't participate.
Four essential playwrights to read. Who are they?
The great 20th century playwrights, as far as I'm concerned. Chekhov, Pirandello, Brecht, and Beckett.
But you say read junk, too.
Well, I tell students, if they're starting out, if they only read masterpieces, they're going to get pretty discouraged. But if they read some junk, they'll say, wow, I can do at least as good as that. Huh. So that's terribly encouraging. And also, reading plays teaches you what to do and what not to do. And if you don't read junk, you won't know what not to do.
Our 2007 conversation with Tony and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Edward Albee, who died September 16th at the age of 88, one of the greats.